Thanks, Susan. I'd you know, just like to start off by thanking NFAC and the conference organizers for giving me a chance to talk to this group. It's I think it's a great topic that I have, and I'm going to try to explore this topic in a few different ways. Something that I think is really a key that I want to emphasize about this topic is movement. Movement is really important, and our organizations need to see movement, and I think NFAC provides an excellent opportunity to make that happen. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our organizations. I work for the British Columbia SPCA. We're a member of the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies, which is the national voice on behalf of SPCAs and humane societies in Canada. And so many of you may not be entirely familiar with who we are, what our objectives are, and how we try to accomplish those objectives. So I'm going to try to give you some information about that and then talk a little bit more about the role that we play in NFAC and how we, as a part of NFAC, which is a really unique forum, how we are actually able to meet some of our objectives by working collaboratively with other stakeholders involved. And then I'm going to conclude with some final thoughts on where do we go next? And this idea has come up a few times already in presentations. I was really happy to see, but once we have a code, where do we go next? What do we do with that code? And how do we use it to provide an assurance that animal welfare is actually being being adhered to, that animals have good welfare? Our organization's been involved, the CFHS has been involved in NFAC since its inception, and my colleague Sheila McDonald, many of you will know, from her involvement on NFAC and the NFAC executive back to 2005 when the council was founded. And so, you know, we're very very proud to play a role on NFAC. And but it's this kind of work, if you were to stop somebody in the street and you were to ask them what picture comes to mind when they think about the local SPCA or Humane Society, they're not going to think about somebody with a scientific background sitting down with farmers and veterinarians and scientists working out high-level policy in a boardroom in Ottawa. That's not what's going to come to mind. So something that Jackie mentioned the other day, or just yesterday, was stereotypes and how NFAC gives us an opportunity to challenge our stereotypes. And in any meeting you come to at NFAC or through the codes processes or other projects, I'm sure everybody around the table has an idea of what everybody else is going to be like and what they're going to say. And I think after just about every meeting, you come away thinking something slightly different because you've learned something about other people. And so on that note, I'd like to give you an example of a pretty common stereotype that people might have in mind when they're thinking about what the SPCA or the Humane Society person is going to be like when they come to the table. So if I could have the video, please. So that's Debbie. So now apparently she's an actor. And she does a bang-up job on that stereotype, but it's pretty over the top. But that's something that you know our organizations have to deal with, the fact that some people might have this impression of us when we step into the room to sit down to work on a beef code of practice. And so we're doing a lot of work, and I hope that the way that we're presenting ourselves and the scientific approach we're taking and our background with agriculture and knowledge about agriculture helps break down some of these stereotypes. When you look at the roots of our organizations, particularly of SPCAs in Canada, they go back to the late 19th century, when you had concerned citizens who, many of which had farming backgrounds. I think just about everybody did back then, I imagine. And they had a really strong husbandry ethic, a really strong animal care ethic, and they saw predominantly working horses and other working animals being abused and mistreated in city streets, and they didn't think that was right. They didn't like how these animals were being treated, and it didn't fit with them and with their husbandry ethic for how animals should be treated. And so they organized to put together some an organization and eventually some legislation to help protect these kinds of animals. And so our roots are really actually in trying to protect working animals and farm animals. And so it's a really, it's still a really important part of our involvement. So the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies, I'll tell you a little bit about it. This is our mission statement. I won't read it out, but I think it's really important to emphasize that we promote the humane treatment of animals. And I'd say we're a pro-ag, a pro-farming organization, provided that that farming and that those practices used to raise animals ensures that those animals don't suffer. That's really our mandate. And I'd also like to draw attention to, I don't know if you can all see it, but I'll read it out. Above the logo, there's a motto: helping Canadians help animals. And I think this is a really critical point, because ultimately we know that by and large, animals, whether you're talking about farm animals, pets, zoo animals, animals in research, they're all owned by somebody. They're all owned by somebody who is responsible for providing care to those animals. And so if we're going to help animals, we need to help the people who own those animals. And there's a number of ways we can do that, and that's a little bit what I'm going to talk about today. So when we talk about humane treatment, this is a theme I'm going to come back to a few times. What do we mean? Because we may all have a different view of what that means, what acceptable animal welfare means. And that's one of the great things about NFAC is it allows us to come together to actually discuss what that means and come to agreement. This is our touchstone, is the five freedoms. And this list is what the BCSBCA uses, which is slightly modified from the original version, which was developed by the Farm Animal Welfare Council of the UK. It more or less has the same sentiment, but the order is a little bit different. And the Farm Animal Welfare and the Council in the UK is an advisory body of experts, which ends up having about the same kind of people involved on it as NFAC has. And they're appointed for their expertise rather than who they represent. But you've got farmers, veterinarians, scientists, academics, government, and humane societies on the Farm Animal Welfare Council. And that's the group that came up with these principles. And so this is sort of our touchstone. And now we know that absolute provision of these to every animal all the time is probably impossible. And in fact, some of them they compete with each other. If you give an animal one, you might take away a little bit from another one. But I think if we shoot for being able to provide every animal with all of these freedoms most of the time, we're probably doing a good job. So how do we promote the five freedoms? How do we try to encourage improved practices in farm animal welfare? One thing I'd really like to emphasize is providing information and educating. And so we do things like we bring out academics and other prominent speakers and scientists like Temple Grandin. BC FAC, the BC Farm Animal Care Council, is bringing Temple Grandin out for their conference in about a month, and we're piggybacking on that so that we can get her to speak to an urban audience too. And if any of you who've seen Temple speak before, she's going to say the same thing no matter who's in the room. But we'll get her, BC FAC will get her out to a farming audience, and we'll get her out to an urban audience, and we'll get her message out to the whole community, which I think is very cool. We put out, these are just a few examples from BCSBCA, but other SBCAs across the country are doing similar kinds of things. And FarmSense is an email newsletter that we send out every 2 months, which has research extension results in it. The main audience really is the agriculture community. We do have a number of members of public who receive that too, who are intensely interested in farm animals. So we send that out with information about what's happening in the industry, some research results, and some sort of testimonials and personal experiences of producers who've adopted alternative methods of practice. And so that they can talk a little bit about the pros and cons and their experience of trying to do something new. We also run a certification program in BC, voluntary certification program called SPCA Certified. We have some producers in Alberta too. And the idea behind this program is that it allows us to help link up farmers who want to strive to meet the highest standards with consumers who are willing to pay more for products that were produced according to those standards. So the farmer is getting a fair return for the extra effort or the extra cost of putting those practices into place. Um, I'm going to talk a little bit about animal cruelty investigations, because this is something that a lot of people have in terms of their vision of who the SPCA is too. But I'm going to use three examples here of different cases from BC that we've dealt with over the past few years to talk about how important the use of providing information and education is in how our officers, I'm not an officer myself, but I work with them, and I think I understand how they conduct their work. And you know, every other enforcement agent from an SPCA in Canada who I've talked to tells me the same kind of thing, that the ultimate objective isn't to prosecute. The ultimate objective is to correct the situation, to improve animal welfare. And if that can be done through providing information about what the acceptable standard is, and working with the producer to come up with a plan for how to correct it, that we're happy. And I've purposely sort of picked non-farm examples here, but the picture to the left is Gigi, who is being kept in that Rubbermaid container as her crate, as her sort of kennel. In that case, our officer was actually able to talk to the owner and say, look, sort of work with the owner to help the owner understand that they really didn't have the knowledge or the ability to provide an adequate standard of care for that dog. And the owner, I think, very quickly realized that they didn't know what was customary in Canada for how to keep a dog, and agreed to surrender the dog to us so that we could place it with another home. And in that case, prosecution wasn't necessary. We fixed the problem, we rehomed the animal, and convinced the person that they're you know, probably just not cut out to be a pet owner. So top right picture is it's a picture of our chief officer in BC, Sean Eccles, displaying some paraphernalia from a cockfighting operation that we investigated, where it was a very large operation, more than 2,000 game cocks that were being bred and raised and trained to fight. This is just outside of Vancouver. And in that case, really the entire purpose behind the organization was not something that you could kind of correct. It was fundamentally criminal. It's a criminal code offense to do this. And so investigation and enforcement and prosecution were necessary to shut that operation down. It's a pretty unique thing. It's not the kind of thing we deal with very often, but it does come up once in a while. And the third case is a picture of two tigers being kept that were being kept in the interior of BC at a roadside zoo. And here's a situation where our legislation and the Ministry of Environment's legislation at the time actually didn't provide us with the ability to do anything in the situation. I think everyone would agree that these tigers are being kept in a really barren environment without adequate space to really meet their needs, and that it was totally, from a human safety perspective, totally unacceptable. That's just playground fencing with a tarp over the top. And it is humorous that somebody would think this was okay, but the owner's girlfriend was killed by one of those tigers. She was standing just outside the enclosure. So it was a really tragic event that happened that could have been avoided if there was some kind of regulation or some kind of perhaps industry auditing program to ensure that zoo animals were being kept according to a certain standard, both for animal welfare and for human safety reasons. And here's the last area of work that I'll highlight, and this is a picture of the Code of Practice Committee for dairy cattle. And this was as we were wrapping up the process. And for everybody right now who's involved in a code committee and really slogging through this seemingly endless process of wordsmithing in a group of 20 people and working through some of the tough issues right now, note that everybody there's smiling, and that's at the end. And this is another theme for that I want to emphasize, is that I might be idealistic, but I hope that we can come out of all of these processes with better relationships than we went in with. And I think we certainly had that with the Dairy Code. I think I'll take this opportunity to mention that one speaker yesterday referred to NFAC as an industry group or an industry body quite a number of times. And I think that's just kind of rolls off the tongue because we're used to talking about, different parties are used to talking about industry consultation. And perhaps what they mean when people talk about industry consultation is non-government consultation with all of the stakeholders. But it's something that I think is really worth emphasizing, that ANFAC isn't just an industry body. And that's where the real value is. We have a range of stakeholders at the table, and we can sit down through processes like the codes of practice, build some relationships, talk about the tough issues, come to agreement, and provide value to consumers, to government, to trading partners, because they see that what's developed through ANFAC is credible, because it's not just industry. It's a wider range of stakeholders involved. So when you look at the dairy code, something that's important to emphasize with all the codes and all the projects that we're involved in is that ultimately our organizations are expected to communicate to the public about the outcomes. Are we happy with what's in the outcome, what's in a code or not? And we look for every opportunity to give credit where it's due in the industry. We look for every opportunity to congratulate industry for either documenting existing practices that provide good welfare or making progress where improvements are necessary. And so here's an example of how we communicated to the public about the dairy industry, about the dairy code after it was completed. So this is our FarmSense email newsletter. The headline in the article was, "Want to know what makes dairy cows really happy?" And the answer was the new code. And you won't be able to read this, but I highlighted some text there, and I'll just sort of paraphrase it. But basically it says, thanks to the commitment of the members of the code committee to adopting science-based requirements for animal welfare in the code, I think we have one of the strongest codes in the world for dairy cattle. And so we had only positive things to say. But it's important to note that things may not always go that rosy. And ultimately, at the table, we're able to come to consensus on issues. But you know, when I start to look around at other countries and look at other kinds of code processes and look at how in certain circumstances things haven't gone well and how people communicated afterwards, you learn some things from that. And so, you know, I picked out one example that I found from the UK, where there's actually I didn't know this, but there's a code of practice for dogs and cats in England. And I don't know exactly how that process works. I get the feeling that it's a bit more top-down government managed than how we do things here. But the British Veterinary Association, one of their priority welfare issues was the issue of healthy breeding practices for dogs. And they clearly felt, based on how they communicated after the process, they clearly felt that had been dismissed, that they hadn't come to consensus around the table about the inclusion of healthy breeding practices for dogs in the code, and they were clearly upset, and they felt like they'd been dismissed. And their statement, once that code was released, was that the British Veterinary Association has welcomed the publication of the code, but has expressed disappointment that the code does not include advice on healthy breeding practices. And so they made it very clear that their full interests at the table weren't being considered. They must have been quite unhappy about that. And in fact, they went further and they actually publicly called for an additional review of the code in just a year, because they said this is unacceptable. This should have been in there, and it was dismissed by the committee. And that's just not good enough. We need to relook at that. So to go back to the title of my talk, which is Moving Forward Together, I think it's important that we talk about forward, what forward is. If I think forward's this way and you think it's that way and we're pulling in opposite directions, we're not actually making any progress. And this isn't easy, and I think this is probably, you know, comes down to the nub of the challenges that we have with animal welfare and trying to negotiate improvement between different sections, between different sectors. And so, you know, when I come across something that's difficult to deal with, I tend to look at the sort of thought leaders, and Dave Fraser's name always comes up. So this is something, a schema that David put together in 1997. I'm sure it's something you've been thinking about for a long time before that. And It shows a concept of how different people have different concepts in mind when they're thinking about what animal welfare is. And there are sort of three different concepts which are overlapping, but that some people feel predominantly that animal welfare is about how an animal feels. Some people feel about whether or not it's the animal is physically functioning well and has good health. And other people think about animal welfare as being whether or not the animal has a natural life, a natural state of being in its environment. And like I said, those concepts are overlapping. And if you were to ask a bunch of people what they thought, they would probably say that they, you know, straddled somewhere between the three. And some people would be right in the middle. There's another Jeff who some of you may know, Jeff Spooner, who's just wrapping up a PhD at UBC, is about to publish a paper in the journal Animal Welfare where he talked to beef producers, mainly in Western Canada, about what they thought about animal welfare. And what one of the things that he emphasized in his paper is that cattle producers talked about all these things. And maybe not everyone talked about all three, but so that's within one, you know, very specific sector. There was a lot of there was a range of attitudes about what animal welfare is, and so even within that one sector, you've got a range. And so what that means is that when we're all talking about animal welfare and well listening to each other and talking about animal welfare. We need to keep this in mind, that if you're only thinking about what your definition is of animal welfare when you come to the table, it's going to be harder to move forward if you're not thinking about what everybody else might be bringing to the table. And so I haven't put a lot of thought into this, but I think, you know, maybe where should we aim in terms of our definition of animal welfare? Maybe we should, as we work on the codes, maybe we should just shoot for the middle. Maybe that's a reasonable place to shoot so that we capture people who think about it in all three different ways. And of course, that's going to be informed also by the scientific evidence that we have in front of us, the scientific conclusions from the scientists' report when we're writing the code. So some of the, now that we have sort of an idea of where we're going, it's important to talk about how do we make that happen? How do we actually move together? And you know, when I started getting more involved in this kind of work a few years ago, I didn't have, you know, having sort of a science background, I didn't have the background in understanding how to sit down and work these things out and to talk to people about them and come to agreement. And this is a great book that I'd recommend anybody read. It's probably 30 years old. It's nothing new, but it's written by a group of people who spent a lot of time observing and participating in and thinking about dialogue and negotiation and of contentious issues. And these guys, who happen to be from Harvard, wrote a book based on their observations. And there were some people that they saw in these processes who were very effective at working as part of these groups to negotiate agreement, but who did so without jeopardizing relationships. Because if we come out of a code committee and have worse relationships than when we went in, it's not going to help us in the long run. It's not a sustainable approach, because there are going to be future code negotiations that have to take place in the future, and there are going to be other issues that don't even pertain to the code that we all have to talk about. And so there are a few key points that these guys mention in their book, and you can get some of the stuff off their website too. You don't have to buy the book, but there are some really key principles, and I personally think that that NFAC and the NFAC secretaries have done, without even necessarily making reference to this book, I don't know, maybe some of them have, but have framed things in this way to try to get to create an atmosphere where you can come to agreement. And so I'm just going to rattle them off. It's important to be tough on the problem instead of the person. And what ideally what you want to see is you want everybody to see themselves as sitting on the same side of the table, looking across the table at a collective problem you have that you need to work together to solve. So it's constructive and it's collaborative rather than combative and competitive. And if you keep personalities out of it and you try to be as objective as possible, and respectful of everybody else around the table, then I think you've got a better job, a better opportunity to come to agreement. It's important to focus on interests and not positions. And that may sound just like semantics, but positions are firmly locked in things, lines that you draw that you won't go beyond. Interests are broader. Interests are maybe the outcomes that you want to see. And so our interest is in seeing improved animal welfare, or animal welfare that comes close to the five freedoms, that kind of thing. And if you get locked into your positions, it's really hard to make compromises and come to the middle. And I'd argue that even if you come to the table and you say, well, our position's here and their position's there, we'll haggle and we'll come to something that's roughly in the middle. Well, okay, I mean, you can negotiate that way and you can come to agreement, but no one's going to be very happy at the end of the day. And I don't think that you're necessarily coming up with a very creative solution. So if you're thinking more about interests of the other parties at the table, you can come up with more creative solutions than just thinking about, okay, what's the midpoint between where you are and I are? There might be a point over here that neither one of you had even thought of before. And if you don't take the time to really listen and understand the interests of the other people at the table and talk through some things, you might not actually come up with this other very creative solution over here that neither one of you would have come up with on your own. And along with that is that it's important to try to come up with creative options for mutual gain. And so before meetings, you know, take a little bit of time to think about what are the interests of other parties at the table, and do I have any creative solutions, creative ideas for how we might be able to write a code requirement in a way that meets both of our interests. One last point on this slide. Benchmarks are really important. Objective criteria that you can rely on, and we're fortunate to have a code process that facilitates that through the scientific lit reviews that are done. Everyone sitting around the table has the same science in front of them, more or less whether you like it or not. We all have to agree that that's the gospel and that these are the facts, and that really helps because we have this consistent set of benchmarks and facts, scientific facts to rely upon when we're writing our code. And so it's really nice that that's been incorporated into the code process. That's a house. This is actually my last slide. Susan doesn't have her water gun out. How am I doing? OK, great. So I think I'd like to build a bit of an analogy here. And I think what we're trying to do through NFAC is, and it's come up a lot of times already, provide an assurance to consumers, to trading partners, to the public that animal welfare is being met, to demonstrate existing practices that do meet animal needs and begin to improve other practices in other areas to meet those needs. NFAC has really provided a good foundation for that. We've got everybody in the room together. We've got some great processes in place, like the code process we have right now, and that provides a foundation. The codes, I think, provide a frame for us to actually begin to plan and implement programs for how we can actually provide real protection. Real protection to the animals and real protection to the industry and to the industry's sustainability. But the frame itself isn't going to provide that protection. The frame is just a structure that we need to start hanging other things off of. So if we're really going to provide that protection, we need to put a roof on and to put some walls on. And that's where I think the on-farm assurance, on-farm assessment comes in. And so this is, again, I'm really happy to hear that I'm not the only person saying this today, but the codes aren't an endpoint, they're a midpoint. And the codes are providing, I think, with the foundation that we have through NFAC, the codes are providing an excellent frame. But as I mentioned, that's not the endpoint. We need to keep building on that frame to actually provide the assurance that animals are being treated according to acceptable standards on farms. And I'd really like to congratulate the industry associations who've made steps with that already, who've put their some programs into place and who are going to pilot the animal care assessment model that we're developing. And I think we have to get people on the escalator, And it's important to walk before we run. But ultimately, and Ed Pager mentioned that some organizations, other organizations are doing this, and I think it was PQA that he mentioned, having an element of third party is important. I think it's really important for the credibility of what's being done. And it may not happen right away. It may not be the first thing you do is to put in a third party element to your program. But the whole concept of what Ed was talking about with PQA, where you have a random sample of producers who are selected for a third party assessment, provides an extra level of credibility to what you're doing. And so that's ultimately, I think, going to be one of the final steps in finishing this house to protect the system that we have, and really to create that system that provides an assurance of acceptable standards of farm animal welfare in Canada. So thanks, and if I've got time, I'll take some questions.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Plowman. I'm from Australian Pork Limited, which I hope you can tell from the accent. Great presentation, Jeff. It was very actually assuring to hear about you working in the model code process and also your respect for farming. When you were talking about your win-win, you gave the importance, you stressed the importance of reaching for not just the middle road, but, you know, the compromise, but to reach for those creative solutions. And I was wondering if you can give me an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Was it? Okay, that's an excellent idea. All right, an excellent question. I actually thought about this before and didn't come up with something. I was trying to come up with something from the dairy code, and I didn't come up with something that really demonstrated it perfectly, but I'll do my best. So, electric produce. If the dairy farmers in the room with the dairy code had come to the table saying, we need prods, they're necessary in certain situations, and that's our position, we're keeping them, and our organization had come to the table and said, prods are unacceptable, we won't tolerate them under any circumstances, we wouldn't have been able to write the requirement which we wrote, which says something along the lines that prods must only be used in emergency situations where human or animal health are at risk. And so there's an example of where a cow's fallen on someone or on another animal, and a prod might be helpful to get that animal up. And so when we sat down, and I think naturally everybody around the table really was thinking in an interest-based way, using an interest-based approach, we really explored each other's interests. And so what is it you don't like about prods? Are there some times where prod use is legitimate and could actually be helpful for improving animal welfare, which is what our interest was? It's not prod use that are as a position that we're concerned about, it's the animal's welfare. And so we wrote something that I think was a very good creative compromise that allowed for the fact that we made it clear that prods aren't acceptable for general use, but there are certain circumstances where it might actually be beneficial to animal welfare to use them. So it's not a perfect example, but it probably illustrates it to some extent. Okay, so Susan's asking about how we dealt with pasture in the code. In the dairy code. Well, we didn't, I actually don't remember what we wrote about it. We didn't write any requirements for animals needing free range. Susan's three steps ahead of me, which is really common. What we focused on, the questions came up about whether or not cattle should be required access to pasture. And so we went back to the science and we started thinking about the outcomes. What are the animal outcomes that you want to see? And ultimately, we talked a lot about how the outcome that had the most sort of scientific evidence behind it was around lameness. And so ultimately, the scientists talked a lot about how it's not necessarily time on grass that's the biggest benefit, it's time off wet concrete that you really need to have. And that's a really complicated thing because it means having good bed stalls. What we focused on in writing that code requirement was the outcome, and that I think the requirement on lameness says something like the fact that animals must be monitored for lameness and steps must be taken to address lame cows when they're identified, something like that. And then there were recommended best practices with ideal targets for what would a suitable lameness rate be on your farm. So I think it's under 10% or something like that. And so that's actually a good example that Susan was able to tease out of me of how we collectively figured, okay, what's the interest? The interest here is in ensuring the animal's welfare. Lameness is the biggest concern we all have, and so let's focus in on lameness as an outcome rather than the inputs. And also in the recommended best practice, I think we recommended that, you know, that giving cows some time on pasture can definitely help reduce your lameness rates as one management or one housing approach strategy to addressing that outcome.
Hi, Jeff. Florian Posberg. I'm involved in the hog industry and writing the new pig code. seems to me that Canada enjoys a different relationship between organizations that you represent and the farming community than what we see south of the border. In fact, we as an industry look south and see, it seems to be quite a confrontational approach between HSUS, PETA, and the various commodities. And believe me, we really appreciate the relationship we enjoy here in Canada. How much stress is it on your organizations, the SPCAs, to follow a more confrontational approach from your constituency?
That's an excellent question. I'll start off with our constituency. Our constituency is really broad. We've got a large diversity of people who are members of our organizations and who sit on our boards, from farmers to vegetarians and everything in between. So our constituency is hard to nail down, but ultimately everyone is coming together with the same goal of humane treatment with, you know, the five freedoms in mind. For me, and this is something that I talk about a lot and sort of sell within our own organizations, it's about the outcomes that we can achieve. And if we can achieve good outcomes for animals through a very moderate, collaborative, respectful approach at the table, why would we waste our time or money doing anything else? If it works and it's proving demonstrated results for improving animal welfare, then that's all we need to do. I don't know why, but that approach just hasn't emerged on a large scale in the U.S. I'm sure there's a lot of that happening on a local level in the U.S. where you've got, you know, some groups getting together with their local SPCA rather than HSUS to work out some compromises on something. I'm sure that does happen. But on a national scale in the U.S., it hasn't happened so much. And I think it's perhaps they can learn from what we do. But ultimately, you know, I tried to sort of relate this earlier, but the proof is in the pudding. So if we can achieve good outcomes for animals, science-based outcomes for animals through the codes process, then it's an excellent vehicle to be able to use.
Neil Jotham, I think you probably answered the question that I was going to raise in some detail. One other one I would ask is that how do you deal with situations which must crop up as you go forward in the codes with a particular member society, for example, are opposed to a particular animal issue in terms of livestock farming, and they simply don't want to stray from that and don't necessarily want to have the Federation's name included as part of the process. I don't know if you've ever experienced it. I'm just thinking mm-hmm. about the early days, but...
That's an excellent question, and we haven't dealt with that yet, at least since I've been involved. All of the feedback that I get from our member societies, which I think number 33 now, 40 now. Excellent news. 40 member societies across Canada. All the feedback I've heard from them is very positive, that they like what's happening. They like the people that we have at the table. We have their support. But that's something that we have to work out. If a conflict did arise, a concern did arise, we have to work that out internally. And like any organization, this isn't going to come as any kind of surprise. This kind of issue isn't going to come as any surprise to the National Commodity Associations in the room, because you have your provincial groups who don't always agree. That's just the nature of the game.
Hi, Ryder Lee, Canadian Cattlemen's Association. Jeff, great presentation, good style. Florian kind of raised it, and you know, the appreciation's there for what CFHS has brought to the table in how you deal with these issues and with industry. But you know, as one of the people who sits around the NFAC board and exec, you know, I'm aware how thinly you might be stretched in. You know, with all these codes and being everywhere, you know, CFHS isn't the grand behemoth that HSUS is. So, you know, talking to an audience like this that sees the value in what you bring, what would you ask for or suggest or look for from this group to help CFHS succeed? Which is important to a lot of the people in this room as well.
Mm-hmm. I don't know offhand. I think that idea is worth exploring, and I still feel like, particularly with all of these code projects going on now and our really high level of involvement now. We've always been involved in NFAC, but there's just so much going on right now, and it's taken some time to build relationships that we're still kind of dating, like Debbie. And we're still working that out. And so if there are opportunities to explore, you know, other ways that we can support each other, then I think that's really important to start talking about. I think what's happening now in terms of the codes, everyone will agree, is unprecedented in Canada. There are 7 in the works right now, I think, and that it is taxing on organizations like ours that have to be on everyone. I know CFIA has the same problem. CVMA may have the same problem. Some of the scientists are now on multiple committees. And it's really good stuff. It's almost too much of a good thing, but we've got a bit of a we've got a backlog to get through, with some codes not having been amended in 20 years. And so we got to get through that backlog, and so we'll see how things roll out down the road in terms of how many codes are being done simultaneously. And I know it's certainly taxing on Jackie and NFAC to have this many done at once. And so hopefully. I don't know if the pace will slow. I think ideally we'd be doing maybe about half as many at once at maximum to be able to make it manageable. But yeah, I appreciate the sentiments, and that's a good question.
Jane Goodridge from the SOW Project. I wanted to commend you, because especially your opening video was excellent, because that's so true. But just a quick comment on your behalf, a clarification, and it makes your job a lot tougher, I think. The Humane Society of the United States is not a humane society. It's an anti-animal agriculture activist group that does very, very little for actual humane society work or welfare or anything. It's basically an animal rights groups. It's not the American Humane Society. They're 2 separate entities. So unfortunately, they took this Humane Society because it sounds really people-friendly and has a good public image, but they're not. So unfortunately, it makes your job tougher when you come to meetings like that, because they're a lot more vocal and obviously a lot more public. Like, they're even stronger than PETA. So it was just a comment on that.
Thank you.